Hey, book lovers, if you're a longtime listener of the podcast, you may want to listen up because we've got a couple of new things to tell you about Libro.fm. And if you're new here, we want you to know that Libro.fm is the best place to buy your audiobooks because it allows you to buy from your favorite local and independent bookstore. You can choose from more than 150,000 audiobook titles and get recommendations from booksellers around the country, all for the same price as that other company. You know which one I'm talking about. Except with Libro.fm, you'll be part of a different story, one that supports community. And now, just in time for the holidays, we wanted to let you know that you can also give audiobook memberships to the book lovers in your life. They come in 3, 6, and 12-month durations. Recipients will receive all of their audiobook credits up front, so no waiting each month for a new book. And they will also receive 30% off all additional purchases during the course of their membership. You can check out the link in our show notes for this deal. And as always, listeners of the Bookstore Podcast can get 2 months for the price of one when they use our new promo code, BookstorePod, all one word. That's a new promo code. Don't use the old one. At checkout at Libro.fm. That's Libro.fm. With each listen, take pride in knowing you're supporting local bookstores.
Welcome to the bookstore.
It's like a book club, but we actually read the book.
I'm Becca.
I'm Corinne. This week is the first week of September for our September reading challenge prompt, which is to read a book that is geared towards, you know, kids, younger people, or a book that it has been banned before. Becca and I both chose young adult novels, I think. So our first read for this prompt is The Marrow Thieves by Sherry DeMoline. I picked it out because it is a book I have owned for a few years. I purchased it at the bookstore owned by Louise Erdrich in Minneapolis. It's called Birchback Books. And Louise Erdrich, who we've read for the podcast before, is Native American, and the bookstore focuses mainly on carrying books by Native American Indigenous people. So that was very cool to see, like, all of that representation in there. It's a beautiful little store, too, in a very nice little neighborhood near a lake, which actually is kind of par for the course for Minneapolis, but yeah. And so I picked that up there a couple years ago. It has sat on my nightstand ever since because I am terrible at reading books concurrently, and I saw this as a great opportunity to finally get to read it. So that's what we've done. I guess I'll just, you know what, I'll just read the thing that you wrote about it.
Okay.
The Marrow Thieves by Sherry DeMoline was published in 2017 by Cormorant Books, which is a Canadian publisher. This is a YA dystopia novel, you know, in that genre. There are many that exist in that genre. In the world of the Marrow Thieves, the environment has been decimated by global warming, and almost everyone has lost the ability to dream. The only people who can still dream are Indigenous people, and because of that, they are hunted in order to perform experiments on them, because it has kind of been figured out that the source of their dreaming is, it's carried, like, in their bones and in their bone marrow. Our main character, Francis, he goes by French or Frenchie, lost his family while they were on the run, and he eventually finds a group of Indigenous people. Miguans is the leader. Minerva is an elderly woman, and there are several teens and younger children. 5 years pass as they slowly make their way north to where they've heard other Indigenous people have set up settlements, hoping to get far enough away from the dream hunters. French falls in love with Rose, and they have run-ins with would-be kidnappers and eventually find out something special about Minerva. So that's kind of where we are. I have a lot of thoughts about this book. I think mostly positive. We can start where we normally start with, like, the style of the writing, the way that the story is kind of laid out, that format, etc. What did you think about that?
So it does have a kind of writing that I do sort of associate with YA. I don't know if I want to call it purple prose, but I have a little example here. This is French describing something that's happening, and He says, there was just that stream of breath and blood and tension rolling from Rose's ear down under the collar of her faded parka. So it doesn't mean, it's like, it doesn't mean real blood pouring out of her ear. Mm-hmm. It's like a metaphor. And like, I guess I don't always love that. I'm sorry. You started out by saying you had mostly positive, and here That's I am okay. with my negative. But it's just, it's one of those things where I can recognize it is that is a very distinct style and people love it. And it's just not for me. And also that sort of like, and this, and this, and this.
Yeah. No, there's like a very specific, like, young adult type voice there.
But it's not like I read it and think like, oh, this is bad. It's just, it's perfectly fine to read. It's just that kind of style. I don't know. It just, not for me. That's all I'll say.
I actually found like the writing itself, I think, to be a little bit more elevated than like normal young adult. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's because like, I didn't find this book to be as stuck in French's head as like a lot of YA is.
Yes.
It is a little bit more plot driven, even though I have some comments to make about that too. It's a little bit more plot driven. And I think like there is more description of the environment, which I really appreciate because like I can't stand it when I don't know where they are. so I liked that about it. And I think the description was strong, and I think you hear like some of that level in the part that you shared, but I do understand why like the very kind it sounds very like I don't know how to put it exactly. I know where you're coming from, where that's not like your favorite type of writing, but I think what elevates it a little bit from most YA is that it's not just 100% stuck in feelings. And I like that a lot better.
Yes, and I completely agree with that. And I think it's one of those things where I didn't necessarily notice or think about it too much because this is sort of, to me, how books should be written. Mm-hmm. Like, we get the characters' thoughts and we get the action, what they're doing, and we get to see what the world looks like around them.
Right.
So, but yes, if I compare it, we've talked about this before with YA. So if I think about that, then yeah, I definitely... This was just, you know, that part is just solidly written, you know.
Yeah. My main complaint with the way that the story is laid out is that I felt like things, I was sometimes very confused about when in time things were. So the book opens and we get, they call it, what, their coming to story?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. Their coming to story. And that is... their kind of history of what brought them to be in this group, the family that they kind of end up living with. And so we get Frenchie's coming to story. And to me, like that, like just dropped you right into the middle of some action. He's with his brother in a treehouse. And then suddenly the recruiters are there and they take his brother, and his brother kind of like talks him through how to escape. And he does. But he watches mm-hmm. his brother be captured in that process. And so that's one thing that I don't always love about young adult novels, where they don't really give you any time to set up the world at all. They just kind of drop you in this thing. And then my problem with that was at the end of the chapter, it's just... that's kind of it. And then all of a sudden, you know, like he's on the run for a little bit. And then the next thing, you know, he's met the family that he ends up being with. I'm calling them family. It's a found family situation. And then it was really confusing because it seems to have a jump ahead in time, but there's no like real indication of that, except for he talks about the little girl, Riri. And he says something like, you know, when I first came, she was just a little, like a child, like a baby, like toddling around, basically. But now she's 7 years old. And I'm like, wait, what happened? When was this? Because there's like no indication to me necessarily that he's grown up. Like at first I thought maybe like a few weeks or months had gone by that he had been taken in by them. And now he's like with them and stuff. But it was literally 5 years. And I felt like that just came out of nowhere. So that to me was kind of confusing. And I didn't love that. I feel like there could have been a little bit more done to like pad that out and make that clear. But yeah, you know, I don't know. That's a little nitpicky. The other thing I found annoying was that instead of focusing on like when things were happening. Some of it was kind of like a recap after something had happened. So a lot of the time that they spend out in the woods and in the wild is kind of scouting to make sure that there's nobody nearby that they could run into that might be recruiters or whatever. And I felt like often it was like people coming back and saying there are people here, or he would come back and say that he had in report to somebody that he had seen people nearby, but there was never like any scenes showing him finding these people. And so that, that always felt like a little jarring to me too. I wish in some ways, and I never say this, but I think this book could have been a little bit longer in order to like fill out those sections.
Yeah, I think so too. I think the time jump, I'm not really sure why that was there, because a lot of so throughout this like road trip they're doing sort of, Miguans will tell stories. Mm-hmm. And then like you already said, you know, each character has their own coming to story. And some of these, it's like, wait a second, you're only now finding out who these people are 5 years.
Yeah. Yep.
After you've known them, what have you been talking about? And that's fine. I don't mind a story where like Wob's story is very, very traumatic. It makes sense to me that maybe she wouldn't share it until 5 years after she's known these people. That makes sense. But then what have you been talking about for 5 years?
I know. Yeah, I think that the thing that bugged me about it is that it would be really, really like minor changes in order to make it make a little bit more sense. And I think it's irritating to me that like those minor changes didn't happen. It just kind of puts it in. And you know what? And maybe that makes a perfectly fine young adult novel. Like, I don't know, maybe the young adults reading it, that's not something that they, you know, grab onto and question. Maybe that's just like something that, you know, more advanced readers might notice and find slightly strange. The other thing that got me, I'm going to get all of my dislikes out of the way right out the front.
Let's do it.
The rest of this, I think I'll be okay with mostly. So there is a part. Also, there's going to be spoilers. Sorry. There is a part, though, where they run into these people who they believe to be other indigenous people that they'll be helping each other, essentially. But it turns out that these people are, you know, traitors, and they're working to find people to basically sell out to the recruiters. It doesn't make any sense to me. So they're with these people. It seems fine. They're sleeping at night. And then all of a sudden, it's early in the morning or something, and Frenchie wakes up and he hears that there is an altercation. He goes out, and the people that they have been with are, they've got Riri, the little girl. She's about 7 years old. And they've got her, and they're like physically just like manhandling her in a way that seems dangerous and very abusive. And they're kind of talking about how like, oh, the recruiters are on their way to like come and get them. What I don't understand is why would they do this physical altercation situation in the middle of the night when everybody had been sleeping if the recruiters are on their way? Like, why wouldn't they just wait till the recruiters were there to get them all? Why are you starting a fight to then, you know, like, that didn't make a lot of sense to me.
It doesn't make a lot of sense, especially since I know they have a gun, but they're way outnumbered.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it also doesn't make sense how it even happens. In the book, it says, I don't like this at all, honestly. It says, like, we didn't lay the blame on anybody. Like, we didn't know who started it, because somebody was supposed to be keeping watch. They were going to take turns keeping watch. Uh-huh. But it's like, you literally don't know. It's fine to not want to place the blame, but like, as a story, I would like to know how this even happened. Like, coming in, what is it called, in media res, is, it does feel jarring and awkward. And then for most of it, French is just like hanging out of his tent, mm-hmm. watching it happen. And it's, again, like, I know Riri was in trouble, but that is a very oddly written scene.
It is. It doesn't make sense, because like, for them to sell them out to the recruiters, like, just wait for the recruiters to show up so that you've got people to back you up in order to gather these people, like you mentioned, you're outnumbered by. And then And then really they should just be able to take them and then it would be all done. Like, they really like royally screwed that up. Like, why go start a fight before those people even show up, right? And then and then Riri ends up being killed at the same, well, like this guy like falls off a cliff with her or whatever, and they die. And I know that like ultimately the whole point is that like Riri had to die, I guess, in order to advance the plot in some way. And also, I think, to showcase how this community, you know, like they care about each other, essentially, which is, I think it was just a really clumsy way of doing that. That was the one where, like, I think that felt like the most, I don't know, like, why did this happen situation for me. And the rest of it, like, you know, it is a YA, so it's like, I don't think it's like perfectly plotted or necessarily it makes perfect sense, but like the rest of it worked perfectly fine as a YA novel for me. But that one, I was like, none of that makes sense. None of it makes sense. So
yeah,
that's my big complaint.
My big complaint, and this is very much the same complaint I have about a lot of YA dystopias, is economically, this doesn't really make sense. So the world is destroyed. We assume that there's not as many, like, resources have been depleted.
Mm-hmm.
Who is paying for these recruiters?
Yeah.
Where is, like, that money coming from? And for so long, like, they've been on the run for 5 years, and this has been happening for, what, 5 years before that?
Maybe, yeah, yeah.
Who is still thinking, and I would believe it if it were like a couple of like super wealthy people, to be honest, because I know there's like currently super wealthy people in our world trying to like live forever.
Yeah.
But it just, it's hard, like the whole conceit of it, unfortunately, I feel bad saying this, but it just doesn't work for me because I have a hard time believing that people would care this much about dreams and still be willing to fund this.
Well, I have
research,
something to say about the dreams thing, because you brought that up in a text message earlier. But I think I definitely agree with you on the time frame. I can't quite figure out why it would take them 5 years to walk north. That doesn't make sense to me.
Yes.
When, like, people would escape from, like, the south of the U.S. and make it north, like, in a matter of weeks or months. Like, I don't understand how it would take 5 years. That just doesn't add up for me. So that I also had that question. It would make a lot more sense to me if this was happening, you know, like, maybe a year or two after the big, like, inciting event happened, in which people were stopping to dream, or, you know, dreaming was stopping and people were going crazy. But about the dream thing, for me, I think you had put it like, I don't think anybody would care that much about dreams. I'm not sure that it's like people are upset because they're not dreaming so much as I think they've said that, like, it drives people crazy. I don't think it's driving people crazy because people are like, I'm sad that I'm not dreaming. I think it's more of, like, a spiritual thing. Like there's something about dreaming that makes people human, I think, that's my feeling, like, reading it. So I think that's probably more of what it is. But I do agree with you that, like, 5 years is an awful long time to have this kind of, like, shoddy system working, like, in a world that's, like, completely falling apart to be about that. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, and that makes more sense, because, like, my, like, fix in my head would be just have it be, like, a cure or an immunity to a disease.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I want to recommend, there's a horror movie called Blood Quantum, which is basically the only people immune to this zombie virus are indigenous people. And it's really interesting.
Yeah, I think if you think about it as the dreaming, like, stopping, or, you know, having dreams stop being kind of a disease, mm-hmm. I think that you can get into it more that way. And I think that's probably part of it. But like I was saying before, how I wish that maybe there was a little bit more to this book. I wish that was explored more, because it felt like it just dropped in, like, a couple of times. Like, I feel like they just kind of were like, people stop dreaming and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that was it. Like, there wasn't a whole lot of backstory, which I know is partially, like, how these sorts of books work. They don't give you too much, and they just say, this is how it is, and now we're on the move. But, like, I do wish that there was more there to fill it out. The thing that I really, and this is where I start to just kind of like project all of the things that I think about regarding like climate change and the climate disasters we're experiencing and the world is experiencing and has been for like the last couple of years that just keep getting worse. And for example, that happened in Pakistan like 2 weeks ago. Like part of what I always tend to think about, and because like I think a lot of the people that I end up reading writing things about climate change online are the doomerists, who are just kind of like, we're fucking failed and everything is over and there's nothing we can do. And one of the things that I always think about is like how that's just such a failure of imagination. And also, mm-hmm. I think it's like such a colonialist thought, especially for like a system, the colonialist capitalist system that got us in this position to begin with. And that's why I think it's like really interesting to get this book from like a Native perspective. And also when I was thinking about the dreams specifically, like lands and traditions that Native and Indigenous people usually have in place have protected their lands, have protected their climates. You know, I mean, there's only so much you can do considering this has now become a global problem. And so I think that idea that like they are the ones who have the dreams or whatever, like that's the imagination that I that I think of, like the lack of imagination that the rest of the world tends to have, mm-hmm. is just that like they have a different way of seeing the world, of behaving in the world, of caring for the world. And that's what I think this book is kind of, you know, putting forth. And so I really liked that. I thought that was really kind of cool, despite like the sort of logical flaws.
And that's why too, like this isn't something that is like, it's not a criticism that is specific to this book. I have a lot of problems with the Hunger Games, how their economy is set up.
Yeah.
It's not feasible. Don't even get me started on like Hogwarts. Either they're in school like 12 hours a day or like 3 hours. Like it just, again, like teacher to student ratio, none of that like makes sense.
I know.
So it's very nitpicky. I will completely admit that. And like little things, I think you saying that, you know, think of it more as a disease. And that's true. If I got a little bit more about how it was affecting people to not dream, uh-huh. I think that's all I really needed. Like a few throwaway lines like, oh, people go crazy. I guess I kind of thought that as, oh, they're upset, you know?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The world yep. is still going. If I got a little bit more sense that like this was on top of global warming, this is another thing that is like destroying the world, that would have helped me accept it as a premise.
It's like, yeah. it's perfectly like the way that I think about like global warming, or the way that I have to think about it, because I have extraordinary climate anxiety, like mm-hmm. terrible, terrible climate anxiety. And so that's one of the things that I always have to keep telling myself is like, there are people out there who can imagine a better world and are working towards a better world. And that's just sort of what I, for some reason, thinking about those dreams as that thing that makes the world better, is the better system for the world, is what I don't know, that thinking of it that way was like, okay, that makes sense to me. And I don't know how I necessarily reached that. I don't know if that's 100% the point. But because I was able to connect those things for myself, I was like, oh, I really like that, you know, as a like a metaphor, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, also, of course, you know, I recognize how close this is to like the 60s scoop that happened in Canada and residential mm-hmm. schools that happened all over North America, as far as I know. So I definitely get that. And I think that the fear in the characters of these recruiters was done really well. You know, I liked all that. I just do happen to be nitpicky about some things in dystopia, but
yeah. No, and I mean, I think you're right. The timelines don't necessarily make a whole lot of sense to me. I don't understand why it would have to work that way, and I don't think it does have to work the way it does. So yeah, it's sort of that seems kind of, I don't know, like a huge oversight to me, but also like I like what this book is doing as a dystopia better than like most of the mainstream dystopias we get. But yeah.
I think that one thing I could have used more is maybe a bit more direction about what we were doing, because the road trip is so long, 5 years, and where they're going is very, very vague. I don't know. Sometimes I felt like, is this the book just going to end with them like still on the road?
Yeah.
I don't know. Just a bit. I don't know. I guess I don't really have anything specific to complain about there. I was like, what is happening? Is something going to happen? You know,
it should be said, of course, that this is the first book in a series. So that's going to be part of it. But yeah, I agree. Like I was saying, like, 5 years to get north to where, to what, and then like for them to sometimes be surprised by finding people, in some ways it felt like the first time they ever came across others, and it's like in 5 years you haven't come across anybody else. Like there were things like that just like, yeah, I think a lot of it would have made more sense, like I said, if some of the details were worked out a little better. It would have made sense if this was them just literally figuring out what they were doing, like for the first time, instead of having like 5 years of it under their belts. Like that makes you go like, what? Why? Like you said, like, why are you just talking about this for the first time when you've known each other for so long?
Yeah.
Different stuff like that.
The only thing I'll say is Canada is really big, and I have no idea, like, truly how big Canada is.
So very large. Yeah.
I did, like, look at Google Maps of Canada, and I was like, and I, like, clicked on some really, really north, like, towns or lakes or anything that I could click on, and I tried to do, like, a directions from Toronto, and a lot of places was just like, you can't, we don't have a route to this place.
Yeah, no.
So that did make me think. I was like, you know what? I don't know. Maybe it does take 5 years to go, depending on how far north they are. It could happen.
That's the thing is, like, does north mean like, you know, we want to go a bit north of Toronto? Because I think that's where it's taking place. Or does north mean like we're going all the way up to like, you know, practically, you know, you can look across the North Pole and see Siberia. Like, how north?
Yeah.
How north is it? There's no explanation for that.
To talk about something that I really loved was how important the language was to the story. I just find linguistics, I guess, really interesting. And so being able to, like, see how much any word that French learned, he like treasured and like, you know, said it over and over again just to like have the feeling of these words.
Yes.
I don't know. I loved that.
Yeah. No. And you think about like these people who had their culture like literally stolen from them, taken away from them. And it was really sweet, I guess, like seeing these young people be so thrilled by Minerva, like anytime, because Minerva was old enough that like she didn't seem like she was with it all of the time. So I think she wasn't being like super consistent always, but like them anytime she kind of broke out new language that they hadn't heard before or a new story from her past and that connects them more to their culture and how like thrilled and excited they were was really I don't know, it was touching. And I liked that too.
I think you could see too in that how Frenchie did learn and sort of change as a person, because he seemed to be, I don't want to say dismissive of what the women did, but he was very proud of like being the hunter and the scout and things like that. And then when he found out that the girls were learning words from Minerva, it seemed like he finally sort of realized, oh, okay, like, I need to learn from, like, women too. Minerva also, not just Meeg.
Right.
So I really liked that too, to find out that, you know, yeah, there was a lot of value in what Minerva was teaching. And to a lot of value in, like, sort of, they didn't have a home, of course, but, like, staying home and kind of things like that, I guess.
Yeah. And I thinking about this a lot because Josh has been reading this book by David Graeber, and it was called The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity by David Graeber and David Wengrow. And it's kind of like looking at a lot of different indigenous cultures and the way that they differ from like what we think of as Western cultures, et cetera, and like colonialism and capitalism, et cetera. And one of the things that really struck me in reading this book is the way that they cared for Minerva. It would be, I would think, incredibly cumbersome to be traveling with a woman who's who knows how old, in her 80s, mm-hmm. in her 90s, who does not have all of her mental faculties with her constantly. And then also they're traveling with a 7-year-old little girl. That would also be really complicated and cumbersome. But one of the things that you find out when you learn more about indigenous cultures, and I mean, plenty of people already know these things. I'm talking about me learning about them as somebody who was not taught them, is just that, like, that's how they cared for their community. They cared for a lot of the times, some of them, and I'm sorry, I'm speaking very broadly, but, you know, a lot of the times they cared for the disabled people in their communities. And you can see, like, the marked difference in the way that we devalue people in our society, specifically the way that we think of the elderly or the very young or the disabled as inconveniences to us. And so they are literally, like, monetarily devalued in our society. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when they lose both Minerva and Riri later in the book, and they talk about how they're able to move faster, but, like, everybody is still devastated because, you know, they've lost in a lot of ways their past and their future. And mm-hmm. that was just, I don't know, that really stuck out to me.
That did to me too. And especially when you put it up against these sort of, like, apocalypse happened sort of stories where people are back to making their life on the run and from whatever's around them, like scavenging and stuff. When you talk about, like, the imagination that goes beyond, like, the sort of colonialism thinking, like, that's mm-hmm. what I thought of too, is, like, they never considered leaving Minerva behind.
Right.
Whereas if you watch any sort of, like, movie that's kind of in this sort of setting, they're immediately going to leave the old, the disabled.
Or they just don't exist out of convenience for the story.
They literally don't exist. And so to have these characters who do need to be cared for, and they're not considered a burden, they are just considered, this is life, this is our found family, this is what we do. Yes, that was just so refreshing to read, just to have people like that in this story.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe that's why it took him 5 years to get north. I guess I give him a little credit on that. But it doesn't make sense on why the society at large is still kind of doing this thing that seems like it's failing. So,
I mean, it's one of the, I mean, yeah, time, if the timeline was compressed a bit, I think I wouldn't be so nitpicky about it. But yeah. And I think, too, they have such a sense of urgency. There's which is good for this kind of story, but does feel at odds with the 5 years, because they're always like, we can't stay here for long. We got to keep going. Got to keep going. But
Yeah.
Anyways,
one moment that I thought was really cute. I don't love romance in young adult novels. Just don't really care for it. And, you know, unfortunately, that is 90% of every young adult book. But there's a part where they find a hotel. It's been abandoned. And at first, they're all really excited to have their own rooms. And so, like, they're all going to sleep in their own rooms. And they've got walls around them when usually they're, you know, stuck sleeping outside with maybe tarps and tents. And so Frenchie is in his own room, and then in the night, Rose comes in, and they are getting slightly hot, slightly heavy, and then suddenly Riri shows up, and she's like, "Are you still awake? I can't sleep." And they let her in, and then the next thing, you know, like, he's waking up in the morning, and literally everybody is in the room with them, and I thought that was so sweet. It was just very cute that, like,
it is.
That's just, yeah, that's another thing that I think about, is just like, the, you finally think that you get like that luxury of these things that you couldn't afford or you didn't have before. And then, like, everybody's like, no, actually, I didn't want the privacy. I wanted to be with everybody else.
Yeah. Well, and just the relationship too between French and Riri. I mean, I realize, of course, because, like we said, Riri dies, that it's built up so much so that it, that moment can be devastating.
Right.
But I did love that this book had that sort of, you know, big brother, little sister relationship that was so close.
Mm-hmm.
And that French sometimes was annoyed by her, but mostly, you know, loved having somebody that close.
Yeah.
Him. Well, should we talk about what Minerva did and what they found out about her and, like, the ending?
Sure.
So Minerva is captured, and she is being, like, in the middle of being tested, and she starts singing, and then that destroys all of the equipment.
And the, like, the whole school.
Yeah. But she gets out alive. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was interesting because, again, this is where I probably could have used a little bit more information, because the bone marrow situation, like, that's where the genes are, what you want to, whatever you want to call it, to dream. But then the singing is very, like, magical.
Yes.
So it's like, you kind of think it's like a science based thing, but then now it's sort of like magical. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I guess that I'm ambivalent about that.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I love the idea that it was an elder who did that. I don't know. It was a bit hard for me to accept that sort of level of magic that late in the story.
Yeah. I don't know if I thought of it necessarily as like science versus magic so much as like probably what they were gathering and trying to gather or whatever it was is essentially what she used. But the thing is that like she unleashed it in a way that like, I don't know. Maybe it's, oh God.
What?
This is okay. So, what I was thinking about is Monsters, Inc.
Yeah, I.
And it feels so stupid to like compare this book that's about like essentially like really incredible like cultural traditions and then like compare it to Monsters, Inc. But that's what I was thinking about, is the way that like when kids like laugh really hard, right? Like that actually like overpowers their whole system, even though like they can also use that power. So like that's kind of what I was thinking of it as, is she had was too powerful and like they didn't have the capacity to contain what she was, you know, what they were trying to get from her essentially.
Yeah. No, I do like that. That in a way helps me understand it a little bit better. I did also, I was going to kind of skip a little bit further and really spoiling the end here, but they run across some more people.
Yes.
Both indigenous and not, which was interesting because I was kind of wondering, I don't know if it's straight out said, but it's definitely implied that like the recruiters and the government, these are white people doing this to indigenous people. And of course I wonder, what about all the other people of color who aren't indigenous to this area? And so two of the people that they meet are actually black women who are nurses. Mm-hmm. And one of the indigenous people that they run into sort of near the end, it turns out to be somebody who can speak an indigenous language, Cree. And they find out that he dreams in Cree. And I love that, too, because I am, as a very monolingual person, it always interests me to learn, like, what language people who speak more than one dream in.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard people talk about before where it's like these are like actors who speak, you know, five languages. It's like, well, if I spend a lot of time in the US, I tend to start dreaming in English. But if I go back to like my, you know, country of Argentina, then I start dreaming in Spanish. I don't know. I love that. It's just so fascinating to me that like our brains can do that. So that scene where they find Isaac and he's like, yes, I dream in Cree. I was like, yeah. Oh my gosh, I love that.
I also started watching The Sandman this week. And so I've just sort of been thinking about like this role that dreaming plays like in our mythologies and, you know, like spiritual lives and stuff like that. And I think that's really interesting too, especially because like in The Sandman, you know, Dream or Morpheus or whoever he is, I don't know, he's got 15,000 names. I can't quite follow along.
Yeah.
Because he's captured for like over a century. And during that time, people are suffering because they're not able to dream anymore and like they stop sleeping. And it's really I think it's interesting just because like I was thinking about that and this where people end up suffering because they're not able to dream and sleep and get the things that we need, I guess, or culturally that we think that we need or that we get from sleep and dreaming. It's just interesting how, you know, like across cultures and throughout mythologies, like that plays such a huge role, and we still don't really understand why it happens or whatever.
Yeah, no, and that's true. I love The Sandman in the comics too, so it is something I probably should have thought of, because that does become like an important part at one point. Like, I won't spoil it, but something that people do, you know what I mean, with dreaming, like it's very important. So I don't know, I guess that's true. Is that, I mean, maybe people would go this freak out this much if we couldn't dream anymore.
Yeah, well, I think the way, because like I said, the way that I've been thinking about it is like positing dreaming as something that like that we have to have, like, yeah, in that like the lack of it somehow would do something to you, like either physically or mentally, like,
yeah.
And that's like not necessarily dependent on like the way that you might think about it or whatever. Like, it would be an unintended consequence of losing it. So yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't think about dreaming that much in my day to day life, but it's, I guess, just interesting to me that the way that it is and has always been, I guess, so like entwined with our thoughts about like the self and, you know, culturally. I don't know, just interesting.
Well, and that too is like, I guess, thinking about it, like dreaming, just dreaming when you're asleep, or is that affecting your waking life too?
Right.
With the inability to really think about the future, we're just in the mind of, or focused on indigenous people who can dream. So that's not going to necessarily apply to these characters, but I would be interested if, I mean, I don't think the rest of the series probably focuses on the people who can't dream, because right, why would it? But that is something that I wonder too, if like, you know, how much it would that affect the waking life to not be able to have those dreams.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. It would be interesting to see like what really is happening in the rest of the world. I understand why you can't necessarily show that just from French's perspective. But if there were, you know, like a few other like perspective, more omniscient kind of perspective pieces like throughout this book, I think that might have helped me get a little bit better grasp on it. But otherwise, I don't know. I think your, you know, complaints about it are all very valid. I just think it was the right kind of book to like capture my, you know, a lot of things that I've been thinking about lately. And it just really, I don't know, interesting things for me to think about specifically. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
No, I agree. And like I said, too, my complaints are very much like the same ones that generally pop up in a lot of YA or just general dystopian novels anyways.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, I'm glad I read it. Like I said, I loved how important language came to be.
I think
that was something that is really left out of a lot of dystopian novels too, because it's easier just to have everybody speak the same language. But
yeah.
But yeah,
Well, I'm glad I finally got the opportunity to read this book, because who knows how long I would have sat on it if I didn't have a prompt specific for it. So if you have read The Marrow Thieves, or tell us about any book that you are reading for this prompt, too. We'd love to hear what you are reading. We'd love to hear what you thought about this book specifically. You can find all the ways you can contact us at thebookstorepodcast.com.
And if you would like to support the podcast beyond listening, you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thebookstore or rate and review us on Apple Podcasts.
Our next book discussion will be Ilatsoe. Is that correct?
Yes, I looked it up.
Yeah, we have pronounced that incorrectly before on the podcast. And that is by Darcy Little Badger. That's Becca's pick for September. You can find it at your local bookstore or library and read along with us.
The Bookstore is a production of Awkwardly Social Media, produced by Becca Young and Corinne Keener. Technical and production support is provided by Josh Bourdon and Zach Titus.
And John, if you're out there, thanks for listening.
See you next Tuesday.
I took your line. Bye.
Bye.